What's up, everyone? I'm Andrew Steinwald, and this is Zima Red. On this show, we speak with the users, founders, and creatives that are diving into the world of unique digital assets, also called non-fungible tokens. My guest today is Jake. Jake is a man of many talents. From art to tech, he seems to be exercising both the creative and analytical sides of his brain with regularity. Jake is probably most well known for being the founder and managing partner of CoinFund, an investment firm focused on the blockchain sector. Having been involved with crypto since the early days, Jake is exceptionally well-versed in all things traditional crypto, and he is extremely knowledgeable about the niche of non-fungible tokens. This expertise allows our conversation to dive deep into mainstream crypto-specific subjects and then into more esoteric NFT topics. We also talk about Jake's keen interest in crypto art and how it's democratizing access to both artists and collectors. And of course, we chat about the metaverse and how blockchain provides the value, identity, and data layer for the future virtual worlds that we will inhabit. It was really great speaking with Jake, and I can't wait to see his continued involvement within the non-fungible token space. Please enjoy my conversation with Jake. Jake, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to chat with you, and I'd love to hear a little bit about your background, because what research I did before this podcast, it turns out, you know, you're a modern-day Renaissance man. Your background ranges from product at Amazon to trading and quantitative research at different hedge funds and trading firms in New York. And I'd just love to hear about how your background led you to crypto, and if you think that your background kind of shapes the way you think about crypto today.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks so much for having me, and I'm very happy to be here talking about some of my most favorite topics. My background is in mathematics and computer science, but as I've said on other podcasts, I tend to have like a dual brain. So like, I really like computer science. I really like math. In fact, that's where what my degree was in. But all my life, I've also pursued like creative endeavors, like art and playing music and things like that. Part of that kind of curiosity and creativity is what led me to blockchain. And I was a pretty early adopter of cryptocurrencies. I learned about Bitcoin in 2011. I started investing in Bitcoin in 2013. And, you know, the way that I really got into the blockchain space full time is that I started one of the first US-based crypto-focused investment firms called CoinFund, and that was in July of 2015, and now it's April of 2020. So we've been doing it for almost 5 years here. Yeah, so that's my background, and then I'm really looking forward to chatting about more specifically about the digital art space and the blockchain-based art space and the NFT space with you here today.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to chat with you about the kind of creative aspects of NFTs and cryptocurrencies. But I'd love to hear more about your initial exposure to Bitcoin in 2011. Obviously, your background's in mathematics, so there's a connection there. And were you studying something with computer science and mathematics, and then Bitcoin popped up? Or how did you initially learn about Bitcoin?
Well, it's a funny story. So I learned about Bitcoin because I had a friend who was a bit of a hacker. He was a very smart guy. He is actually in the space today. He told me about Bitcoin in 2011. Just because he was on, I guess, some cryptography mailing list or something like that. And that's the first time that I heard about it. And I this must have been in like mid-2011 or late-2011. And I tried to download like the Bitcoin client and tried to mine some Bitcoin on my laptop. And my laptop heated up and overheated. And I was like, what is this crap? And I really didn't get it at the time. What's so funny is that a few years ago in 17, which would have been like, you know, 6 years after my friend Will showed me Bitcoin, I called him up and I was like, hey man, you must be swimming in Bitcoins by now. And he was like, Bitcoin, what's going on with Bitcoin? And he actually didn't follow it at all for a long time. And then after that, he started following after my phone call. And now he actually works at one of the crypto startups in the Bay Area here. So that was a fun journey. But that's the answer. The friend showed it to me and that's how I knew about it.
So what are your views today on cryptocurrencies? Because obviously we had 2017 with the huge, massive bubble, a lot of hype, not a lot of great fundamental projects being built from that. There are slowly coming out of that. There are some amazing projects. But what are your views on cryptocurrencies today? Are you more kind of the DeFi blockchain focused person, or are you really bullish on many different cryptocurrencies being used widely throughout the world?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I started like everyone else in Bitcoin and still, you know, very much appreciate the innovation there and hold Bitcoin, obviously. But as an investor, I've never been the sort of Bitcoin maximalist that that a lot of people tend to be in that space. In fact, CoinFund, you know, from the very beginning, you know, the core of its thesis was really about how do we use this technology to do many different things and not just currencies. Now, to be clear, I think currencies are an important component of that. I think, you know, Bitcoin and sort of like the bigger, more well-known assets are trailblazing some of the path for our industry into traditional world, and they're incredibly important for our space. But I think that, you know, currency in and of itself is just one innovation that's possible with decentralization technologies. And I've devoted the last 5 years to studying, you know, how exactly or and how many different ways that that can be done. So I'm generally a pluralist, not a maximalist. I think there's going to be a lot of currencies. We see them in the market today. It's true that we had a bubble in 2017, but I do think we will find many, many different use cases for digital assets in general.
Do you think that there will be 50 dominant blockchains in the future, or do you think that we're talking about millions of blockchains in the future?
So this is like a question that I love thinking about, and it's really like kind of comes down to like what you mean and what perspective that you have. So since I'm an investor, let me tell you the investor perspective. So the investor perspective is that this question always gets asked in the context of like, you know, which smart contract platform will take everything? Will it be Ethereum or Polkadot or Cosmos or Near Protocol or Tezos? And I think that's kind of like the wrong and at the very least a very imprecise question to ask, because as an investor, what you're doing is you're trying to find assets to invest into. And to say that Polkadot will win, right, it is sort of like a very imprecise statement. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that the asset of Polkadot captures all the value of all the commerce that will take place on blockchains? Does it mean that Polkadot, the substrate framework, will be the basis upon which the vast majority of blockchains will be built in the future? You see, and like those two outcomes of winning, right, are very, very different. So from the investor perspective, the investor wants to know where does the value accrue, because he wants to buy that asset. He wants to, you know, make a return on the appreciation of that asset. If you take the investor view, then I think the question you need to be asking is like, in which zone will an asset capture value? And so, for example, in, you know, Ethereum, presumably that asset would be Ether. In Polkadot, it would be DOTS, but that would only apply to the parachains of Polkadot that use DOTS for security. In the context of just a plain substrate chain like Edgeware, right, that maybe isn't connected to the security mechanism in Polkadot, maybe the value would accrue in EDG. And so do I think there's going to be millions of blockchains? Absolutely. I think there's going to be millions of blockchains. I think that as a technologist, right, like I know that, you know, one size fits all doesn't work for all applications. We can go into that. I think people are going to need different architectures and have different requirements for what their apps will do. And we see many projects moving onto app dedicated networks today. We see, you know, just off the top, Aragon Chain, Centrifuge, right? Like we could probably name, you know, tens of them. So I think there's going to be millions of blockchains. But where will be the zones of assets that capture the value of that growth? I think there'll be like a power law around which assets are sort of more utilized, more important.
So are you really bullish on interoperability? Interoperability chains like, you know, Cosmos, Polkadot, et cetera? Or do you kind of think what we're seeing now with Ethereum is that Ethereum is having tons of different dApps and applications built on top of it, whether that's from DeFi to NFTs? And it seems to be having, you know, I don't know, 70 to 80, 90% of market share in terms of developer mind share. Do you think that we'll kind of continue down the route of Ethereum dominating? Or do you think that as these interoperability chains progress, or these quote unquote Ethereum killers progress, that Ethereum will lose its developer mind share and will go towards a more distributed system of blockchains?
That's a good question. Again, it also depends a little bit on what you mean by dominate. But I think what you mean is, you know, is it going to continue to be sort of a very important top of mind system, which has most of the developer activity? And I think like short to medium term, absolutely. I think interoperability is happening. I think if you look at Cosmos and Polkadot and Near, et cetera, you'll find networks that are bridging to Ethereum. And that's, you know, for good reason, is because a lot of the early adoption, not the early majority adoption, but like the early enthusiast adoption has occurred on Ethereum, like full stop, like that's it. And so, you know, anyone who is kind of interested in technology there or is, you know, knows that their application needs to springboard from that kind of tension and network effect, you know, knows that they'll probably have to integrate with Ethereum. Now, over time, in the long term, I think interoperability of chains is inevitable. I think different innovations of different chains is inevitable. The interconnectivity of those chains is inevitable. And the costs of moving from one chain to another, you know, will be mostly about, like, what are my requirements that I need in the app? Like, I think over time, the infrastructure that we've built of blockchain becomes, you know, relatively transparent. It's basically the cloud. It's the back end of the applications that we're building in Web3. And I think it will be easier to move from one platform to another just because, you know, there'll be more interoperability in the tooling and the programming languages as well. So I see that as a inevitability over time. But again, like as an investor, the question becomes like, you know, what do you invest in to capture sort of the, you know, the temporary value that's created or the long-term value that's created?
You bring up a lot of really good points there. And so you previously mentioned that you kind of have both the analytical side of your brain and the creative side of your brain. And I imagine NFTs as kind of the perfect combination of creative plus kind of technical. Is that what first attracted you to NFTs, just your natural inclination towards this creative stuff? Or what was it that first attracted you to the non-fungible token space?
Yeah. Well, I've been sort of doing art like my entire life, but I've never even considered the possibility of being able to sell work, right? So it was precisely the innovation of decentralized open global markets that we tend to see in blockchain that attracts me to this idea that, like, as a creator, I can create, you know, a piece and I can monetize it. And as a matter of fact, I am an artist in my capacity as an artist. I'm on a few platforms today. I'm on Super Rare. I'm on Maker's Place. I've minted some tokens on Mintbase, and I've minted some tokens on Rarible. And I've actually sold a number of works. I don't know how many, but probably like in the order of 10. And my best sale was probably around $330 today, which is incredible for someone who doesn't spend all of their time, you know, being a professional creator. Like, I love that I can take my hobby and monetize it. And that same principle is then completely disruptive for people in, you know, let's say the developing world. So one artist that we featured in first edition, which is my digital art gallery we could talk about, is called O Savage. And this is someone who is an immigrant in the United States, you know, from Nigeria, and he drives an ambulance 6 days a week, right? But he has this insatiable desire to create art in his phone. And when we featured him and he made a sale, he just couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that he could monetize his art. And similarly, you know, more recently, there was another artist, like, actually directly from Nigeria that we have in our gallery, named Osinachi. And this is someone who overcame, you know, being in a country where most people don't even have internet access, never mind like access to tools of digital art making, but persevered and is currently considered kind of the foremost crypto artist of Africa. So it's those kinds of applications, right, that I think move the needle in the world, that really create impact. And part of the thing that attracts me to the space as an investor is that I think this could be a huge market. And the other thing that attracts me is that this is going to be a high impact space for a lot of people. So that's why I'm interested in it.
I want to know if you think that digital art is kind of the next period in art history. Like, is it an inevitable evolution of the art market? Like, is this a for sure thing in your mind, or is it going to be some smaller niche off of the main art industry?
Well, I want to say that it's just very high likelihood. I mean, you know, ever since the internet was invented and really went mainstream in the 90s, which is not that long of a period of time, but the trend that we see is that everything is going online. Everything is digitizing. We're upgrading our legacy systems. We have mobile, right? And in that context, it's very natural that people make art and that art is digital. And in fact, there's a ton of digital art on the internet today. What's sort of the case, though, is that the vast majority of people who create digital art and put it online don't think of that as monetizable. Like, they see it as a promotion mechanism for their art that they sell in kind of the analog world, but they don't think about the internet as almost like a commercial medium for their art. And I think what NFTs do is they change that dramatically. And, you know, there's a lot to say. There's a lot more detail to go into there.
Yeah, I like to say that before the internet, artists had to basically deal with galleries completely. The galleries had control over the media side of the art business, of the creator's arts, and also the financial rails, because they would sell their art through the gallery. And now with, you know, now with Instagram and social media and stuff, the artist has control over their media side. So that was a huge step up, but the gallery still had control over the financial rails. And then now with NFTs, it's almost like the artist now has control of their media, thanks to social media, and then the financial rails, thanks to NFTs. So I think it's a huge step of evolution that's giving the creators just immense power to really create and go directly to their patrons and their collectors, which I think is incredible.
Yeah, and we see that in a bunch of other contexts, right? Like with things like Patreon, not just visual art, but people making music, people doing creative endeavors, people crowdfunding for films. We see that as a general trend. And to be clear, I do think that, like, you know, there are roles for people like investors, there are roles for people like galleries. These are all sort of curators of economic opportunities, you know, at a very abstract level. But you're absolutely right. Like, if an artist wanted to go out there and promote themselves and sort of make all the money for themselves, they're more than empowered to do that with this technology.
I 100% agree. And also, going off of what you said about curation, I think it's even more important, which is odd that I say that the artist has all the power now, but I think it's even more important, curation, in this realm, because in 2 years, 5 years from now, the amount of digital art is going to grow exponentially, and you're going to need some sort of curation tool, because imagine if you had the internet just in an unfiltered sense, you know, it would be totally overwhelming. So you need stuff like Reddit, you need stuff like, that's why you follow certain people on Twitter, that's why you follow your certain friends on Facebook. There's only so much of that your brain can handle. So you need to curate your experiences for sure. And going off of that, I'd love to hear more about First Edition, which is, I believe it's a crypto art gallery that you started a few years back, I believe.
It started in last year, actually. And so the context for that was that I, as an investor at CoinFund, we did an investment into a very small investment in a company called Additional, which was sort of operating at that time. And Additional built kind of an Instagram, almost like social feed, where people can upload, you know, an image or a work of art, really, and tokenize it through the app. And it would tokenize into several editions, and the author would get the first edition. And the first, you know, number of followers that would claim the other ones would just have the other ones. And what Additional demonstrated was a few things. So one is that it created a ton of great engagement just by being a mobile app. And so probably the vast majority of the 5,000 or so creators that were operating in NFT world, O Savage being one of them, you know, onboarded onto Additional, were using it at that time. And number two, it also showed that people sort of valued the first edition more than the later ones. And that was the inspiration for my art gallery, which is called First Edition. And so the reason I launched it was partly because I love this stuff, and I wanted to support the artists that were finding a new medium that they didn't think that they could have before, you know, for their visual works. And the other one is because I see the main problem, even like a year later in the NFT space, is that there really is a lack of demand side. And when I say demand side, I mean this is like the long term, you know, people and entities and institutions that will be interested in buying digital art in the form of NFTs for the sake of buying and holding them. So these might be museums, these might be collectors, right? And that part of the market hasn't formed yet. We do have a bunch of buyers in the market. These tend to be, you know, crypto enthusiasts or other artists who are supporting their friends, and even some fairly well capitalized, what we call whales in blockchain, right? But we don't have that long-term holder market. And one thing that I wanted to do with First Edition was to facilitate the formation of that market. And the way that You know, we do that as we support artists, we buy their work, we pay the rates that they that the artists sort of assign to their own works on the different platforms, or maybe we'll participate in an auction. And then those artists go into our portfolio. Some of the artists displayed on the site, some of them you could see in our wallets. We have a newsletter where we feature artists. You know, and I think a very important aspect of this is also in terms of royalties. So if we have an artist in our portfolio whose work we bought and we resell that work, we'll give that artist a royalty even though we have already paid for their work. And that's because we want to create an environment where artists find it really rewarding and sort of a friendly community where they can come in and realize that, hey, like I can do this as a job. And, you know, and I think the long-term sort of investment opportunity comes later when the space is more established and when we've helped to form kind of a healthier two-sided market in the NFTs.
I love that. You're really focusing on the long-term game and not really looking to, you know, quickly flip, but you're really looking to build out this industry and give it a very solid standing. I think that that's awesome. So which NFT niche, because, you know, there's all sorts, there's collectibles, there's digital art, there's game items, there's virtual land, et cetera. Which NFT niche, in your opinion, has the most potential long-term value?
Well, so this is where it gets really interesting. And this is where I argue that digital art is actually a very, very interesting use case for NFTs. So let me tell you why I think that. But to set the stage there, maybe let's talk about what's actually happening in the NFT space. I have some interesting statistics because I've been following the space for a while. And so just to set the stage, something very interesting happened in end of October, early November 2019, which is that the on-chain volume of ERC-721 tokens of NFTs have surpassed the on-chain ERC-20 volume on Ethereum. And from November to at least the end of January, I want to say, I don't have like the exact numbers in front of me, they continued to grow beyond the volume of ERC-20. So there's been this uptick in interest. Now, where is that interest coming from? Well, if you look at OpenSea and you look at the top 10 sort of assets that are transacting, you'll see 4 virtual worlds, 3 games, 2 NFT platforms, and 1 Urbit address space, which is a different kind of NFT that's not that creative. But what this tells us is that, you know, if we measure the kind of volume in Ether, the top 10 have about $17.2 million worth of annualized volume. And if you go to the, you know, if you measure like a long tail of assets, I'm sure that goes up to, I don't know, 25, 30 million, something like that. If you look at OpenSea, which is the aggregator of most of these assets, you know, on chain, it looks like OpenSea is doing about, you know, $1 million to a little bit over $1 million of transaction volume in a month. And so that's about 12 million, maybe a little bit more, maybe 14 million or something like that, annualized volume. And OpenSea is by far the largest platform. So just right there, we can see that, you know, we can tell this is like not a huge space. It's very, very early. But what is really interesting is that for the first time, NFT art platforms, 2 of them are in the top 10. And as a matter of fact, there's 4 virtual worlds in the top 10. But if you look at what virtual worlds are doing, the number one use case for virtual worlds is building museums to display NFT art. And that's super interesting. And so the reason why I think that art is an actually really interesting space, like as an investor, is because I think that it can experience like much more growth than other areas. First of all, nobody knows about this. This is a new market. And so right there, right, like it has a potential to grow. Art buying is subjective. And so there's no almost like limit to how many people, people will pay for art. And if you've seen any of the Murat Pak pieces on Super Rare, you know that some of them went for $7,000 a pop or a few $1,000s a pop. And, you know, this is a demonstration that kind of established creators can move digital art at, you know, fairly high pricing. That also creates like this awesome incentive. There's another kind of more professional creator on Super. His name is Brian Brinkman. I think he's a professional cartoonist. He's got about 40,000 followers on Twitter. I think he works for Jimmy Fallon. And, you know, he's shown that that he can sell works for about $300 a piece. And, you know, I mean, 40,000 followers is a lot, but it's not a lot relative to, I don't know, the Kardashians or something like that, right? And so even though that's not that many followers, because Brian is seen as a professional creator, he can move work at higher prices than others. And like, you know, that's a huge value proposition for existing creators. Now, when I go on Instagram every day, I have like hundreds of creators on my feed who've never even considered the possibility that they can take their work and put it on a platform like SuperRare and actually make money. And I think once they realize that, you're going to have a stampede of creators going into these platforms.
Wow, I absolutely love that. There's a whole bunch to unpack there. But so just really quickly, I want to ask you, so do you think that the digital art will be as common as people having Instagram profiles? And do you think that in their pictures, they'll also include like, you know, their favorite digital pieces that they've purchased? And I'm talking about, you know, 5, 10, 20 years in the future. I'm not talking about tomorrow. But do you think that this will be a mainstream thing where everyone's kind of a collector and like an art enthusiast? Or do you think it's going to kind of maintain this small niche of really passionate people?
I think, you know, most art today, it goes at a pretty high price point. Like if I can think of like one tech art startup, it probably would be Artsy. And, you know, you go on Artsy and you buy art for anywhere from like a few thousand dollars to $1 million, right? And that's probably where most of the pricing is. Now, most people are not going to go do that. Most people don't have $10,000 to blow on a really crappy piece from like Damien Hirst, right? And there's no consumer behavior that says that, like, I'm actually going to go and buy a real artist's work. Now, I think what happens is when you put a lot of these quote unquote like middle market creators or enthusiasts or just professionals who didn't sell their creations this way before, when you put them on the market, what you do is you lower the price point of art and it becomes a lot more almost acceptable, much more of a consumer, like a normal consumer behavior to actually go and, you know, quasi seriously support an artist by purchasing their work. And that's facilitated by the technology, that's facilitated by sort of its ease of use, it's facilitated by the global markets that this blockchain standard creates, and it's also facilitated by the economics, because when we lower that price point, we make this art a lot more accessible. So when you look at it in that light, I do think it's pretty likely that people, you know, more people will start buying more art over time as its price comes down.
That's really cool. So you think that because of the art is now being digitized, that it could expand the actual market size of the art market massively?
There's no question that that digital art is a growing, you know, sort of space. The only thing that hasn't been growing up until this point is the kind of the liquidity mechanism of that art. Like, how do you, like, once I've created digital art, how do I sell it, right? And that's exactly what NFTs and blockchain open markets create.
And you briefly mentioned that you were tracking the ERC-20 total volume versus the ERC-721 total volume. And you said that ERC-721 had surpassed ERC-20 in roughly November or October of 2019.
That's correct. If you want to see that, it's on, I think Coinmetrics is the folks that did that. If you Google ERC-721 surpasses ERC-20, you'll find it.
That's absolutely incredible. I can't believe I haven't seen that yet. That's actually bodes extremely well for our ecosystem. So I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, like, because a lot of these platforms are on the blockchain, we get incredible insights into how people are using NFTs just by looking at sort of the smart contracts of some of these platforms. And I just had a tweet the other day and it said, fun facts about NFT digital art space. Buyers prefer auction sales more than 80% of the time. You could see that from like SuperRare, like most people will bid rather than just, you know, shop. And I think part of the reason why is because, you know, auctions create, like, it's a game, right? It's a competitive game. So it creates more engagement, but also it's a price discovery mechanism. It's hard to value on-chain art, but if I see how much other people are paying for it in an auction, you know, I might have a better idea of how to evaluate it relative to everyone else. What's interesting is on on a platform like SuperRare, where there's a lot of bidding, there's actually three times more capital, like, looking to buy work, rather, like, versus how much volume actually transacts. So in other words, there's like three times more capital that's like willing to exchange money for art, but they don't necessarily win the auction, right? So getting those kinds of on-chain stats is not only about, you know, the standard and what's going on in Ethereum, but it's also about like what's going on the platforms, like how are consumers behaving? How much money are they paying? The average amount of money that someone has paid for work, not just bid, but actually paid, is something like $71.
Yeah, I actually saw that tweet thread last week or whenever it was, and it was just filled with so many juicy tidbits of information. I immediately thought that you need to start your own coin market cap of NFTs, because the space desperately needs more data and more information. Because, you know, right now we have nonfungibles.com and OpenSea, which are great, but your insights were super revealing, and I just loved it. So anyways, if you're not too busy at CoinFund and everything else that you're doing, then I suggest you do that. But all right, you briefly mentioned CryptoVoxels and kind of virtual worlds and how that their growth is pretty correlated with the growth of the art market, because the number one use case is kind of making galleries and showing off their digital art. What else do you think about CryptoVoxels? Do you think that it's purely a place for digital art for now and it'll evolve into something more? Or do you think it's kind of become the kind of social network for digital art?
I don't know. That's a good question. Well, first of all, let me say I've chatted with the founder of CryptoVoxels, who's a gentleman named Ben Nolan. And I really appreciate how he's built the world, right? Like, he kind of took this very open approach where he didn't sit on his project until it was perfect. It was quite the opposite. He launched it as soon as it was viable with all the bugs. And then he would just like tweets all the time, like, oh, I found a new bug, like, let me fix it. Or here's a new feature that I launched, right? And all the development of CryptoVoxels has almost been done like in the open on Twitter. And I think that's partially responsible, you know, for attracting a lot of folks into the world, and specifically artists. And when they realized that they could actually go in there, you know, and using no tools whatsoever, it's all in browser, they could just build, you know, basic buildings and structures and galleries and put NFTs on the walls. I think this use case took off. And what I kind of love is, like, if you guys have ever heard of one of the art platforms called async.art, I believe the founders, Nate and Conlon, they actually met inside of CryptoVoxels. So, like, you know, it seems like this world is a place which is currently attracting folks that like NFTs and like to display art. Where it goes from here, you know, I think there's a lot of possibilities. Like, you and I, Andrew, talked a little bit about Fortnite, right? And Fortnite is immensely popular in the traditional world. And I think there's a lot of room in worlds like CryptoVoxels and Decentraland to incorporate gaming and commerce, you know, and many use cases, not just art. But I do think that art is driving it right now.
All right. So when I was doing a little bit of background research on yourself, I learned that you have something called the NFT Vault. And I also spotted that you have CryptoKitty number 12, which is insane. So amazing. Could you tell me a little bit about the Vault? And also, I'd love to hear the story about CryptoKitty number 12.
Yeah. Well, the Vault is just kind of a more secure address where we sort of keep art on back storage at First Edition. And there's also a bit of curation, I think, that needs to go into that, since vaults are public. And so I'm kind of in the process of understanding, you know, what should we put into, you know, what should we put forward, like, as works on our website and works that we're like kind of ready to sell to those long-term demand side folks, versus works that we sort of want to hold on to in the vault and go long on. And generally speaking, I've always felt like CryptoKitties, especially some of the rarer ones, you know, is an asset that I kind of want to go long on. The way that I acquired the 12th CryptoKitty is actually, you know, I was just sort of, I had my, like, as an investor, I had my hand on the pulse of the NFT space, and I heard about CryptoKitties. I checked out the website. I was sort of there in that first day when they launched it and had kind of the auction for the first, I think it was like the first 100 founder cats. I was seriously considering buying number one. It ended up being too expensive I know who owns it, and you know, I wonder what they think about it now. But I ended up buying number 12, and I've just sort of held on to it since then.
That is absolutely amazing. You know, I think that that's a really important piece of the digital art or digital collectible ecosystem. And if this space is going where I think it's going to go, I think that that's going to be you're going to own essentially a piece of history. So that's incredible. So I want to ask you about the metaverse, because I definitely have a very keen interest in this arena. And just a brief overview, the metaverse is a persistent virtual environment that people live, work, and play in. I think that a lot of our work is already done online, whether it's through Zoom, Discord. You know, we play a lot of games online, we meet our friends online and play games, and et cetera. So we're already doing a lot of that. What are your thoughts on the metaverse? Do you think that we're already in it now, or do you think that it's going to take, you know, 50 years for it to really become, you know, a true metaverse? Or kind of tell me, what are your thoughts on the metaverse, and what roles do NFTs play in the metaverse?
Yeah, I'm still sort of forming an opinion about it. I have a very sort of academic understanding of the metaverse. Like, I personally don't spend a lot of time in gaming environments and things like that. But obviously I spend a lot of time on the internet communicating with people and stuff like that. So the way that I see the metaverse, you know, sort of on a like a current practical level, is it's probably like a combination of, you know, the gaming environments, the communication environments, and then probably in short order, VR and AR. I do have a VR headset at home that I sometimes use for, you know, traversing like crypto voxels and things like that. So I think it's real. I think a lot of people spend time in these things. I think historically the metaverse has been fragmented into these different areas, but in many different ways, those areas are coming together, right? Kind of gaming has always been seen as a little bit of a, you know, stigmatized, like kind of like antisocial thing, right? But over time, the gaming environments become, you know, very much like virtual worlds where you can go and actually be very, very social. And that's been going on already for 20 years. So I think it's real. I think VR has been tough generally as a space. I think AR has been tough, like, to implement technologically, but we're making some very interesting progress with, you know, Apple's latest, you know, launches and things like that. And I think, you know, from my perspective as a blockchain investor, I really think that blockchain will provide kind of the value, identity, and data layer for this metaverse. I don't think that the metaverse should be owned by a private corporation or, you know, a consortium of corporations. I think users should have kind of self-sovereign access and control over their data. And that's why, like, you know, as CoinFund, like, we're invested in projects like, you know, Threebox, for example, which facilitate those kinds of systems.
Yeah, I completely agree that basically what NFTs allow today is they allow digital property rights. And in the future, when there is a virtual environment where people are spending a lot of, or the majority of their time in, those rights are going to be extremely important. And you're absolutely correct that there shouldn't be one central company that has basically control over this entire experience that we have online. That would be pretty dystopian. But I do think that, as you mentioned, Threebox, and then there's IPFS and Filecoin, stuff like that. There's people that are building solutions to kind of decentralize and democratize the hosting and kind of, yeah, the servers of these virtual environments. So I think those are going to play a massive, massive role in the future. But it's, you know, it's baby steps. So we're doing step by step. We're starting with NFTs, and then we'll go with the decentralized infrastructure, and yeah, we'll eventually get there. But speaking of metaverses, I want to ask you about Travis Scott. He recently had a concert in Fortnite, and I think it was 27.5 million people were, you know, in attendance, quote unquote, during that concert. And so I just love to hear just general thoughts on what you think about that concert and what it means for just the world of virtual going forward.
Well, I think it's a data point in sort of this metaverse track that we've been discussing, right? I think the environment of Fortnite is, you know, on the one hand, like, part of this kind of metaverse idea. It's also an environment where people demonstrably own and trade many different kinds of digital assets inside the game. And this is really what gets some of the, you know, the collectibles and gaming NFT people really excited, because they say, look at Fortnite, right? They're doing billions of dollars of volume in digital assets. And, you know, and interestingly, so at CoinFund, we have a partnership with the partners at Venrock and David Pakman. And one of the, you know, one of the few areas that they have made investments in blockchain is actually Dapper Labs, right? Like the creators of CryptoKitties, they led around there. Venrock, as a consumer experience VC, I think they understand the value of digital collectibles, and that's why, you know, we're both super excited to, you know, to see the launch of Dapper Labs' Flow blockchain and the collaboration with the NBA, the NBA Top Shot product that they'll launch. So to answer your question, I think the last time, this is, someone told me this, I think the last time that there was some kind of concert in Fortnite, they had about 10 million simultaneous viewers. Travis Scott, you said, was 27 million. So that sounds like it sounds like they broke a record there. And, you know, to me, that's just a data point that, you know, this is becoming more real. And I think we can find blockchain use cases. I think people will find that blockchain kind of technologies will be a better fit for these worlds than again, like private issuers.
All right. So where do you see your involvement with non-fungible tokens going? And this can be just personally or also through coin funds.
Well, I'd love to see my fund eventually invest in some NFTs. Actually, we, you know, to be fair, we are invested in some ERC-721 assets today. Like one notable asset would be Urbit Land, which we mentioned before as one of the top 10 OpenSea assets. But we don't have any kind of, you know, NFT like artwork as a fund, and frankly, it would probably be pretty dangerous to invest in that kind of asset right now. But my hope is that what we show is that NFTs can be a financial asset class. And this is something that like very few people talk about in the NFT space. So I know there's a lot of projects currently that are looking at things like, you know, how do we make NFTs more liquid? How do we, you know, fractionalize ownership in them? How do we get loans where the collateral is, you know, a non-fungible work of art or some other kind of NFT? And, you know, this is all very interesting because I think once some solutions are proposed and once that technology gets figured out, I think digital art gets plugged into, you know, the DeFi ecosystem. And then you can do things like, you know, use NFTs as, let's say, MakerDAO collateral to issue DAI, or maybe you can get a loan and things like that. And that to me is, you know, it's hugely democratizing because traditionally, you know, big high value art is used, you know, for tax purposes with high net worth individuals. But now, you know, owners of digital art not only can enjoy the art lower price point, but they can potentially, you know, use it as a financial investment as well. And that's very exciting. So I think that's an underappreciated aspect of the space.
I love that. All right. We were briefly talking before we went live about how you love to experiment in the space and you're kind of tinkering and looking at all sorts of different niches within crypto. And one of the things we spoke about was social tokens. So I would love to hear about your experience with social tokens and what you're doing in that realm.
Absolutely. So you said an interesting thing, Andrew, which is you said like, you know, we really need some kind of index for the NFT or art space. And I totally agree. Like why might we need that? Well, if you're an investor and you think that the NFT space is super exciting, you want to invest in it, you know, your options right now are fairly limited. Like you can say, I'm going to go and try to buy art that I think, you know, will appreciate later, or I might try to discover the artist that makes it big, or maybe I'll become an equity investor in a startup like, you know, OpenSea or Super Rare or Known Origin or Async.art or something like that, right? But that's sort of like where the opportunity ends. And, you know, if there was some kind of like index of digital art in the form of NFTs, or if there was some kind of index where, you know, you could just put in some money as an investor and get exposure to the side of the space, that would be a phenomenal financial innovation that would bring a lot of capital to the space. And that would be great for artists. It would be great for the two-sided market and everything else. So how do we do that? And so one interesting aspect of this is social tokens. So social tokens can, you know, are basically just cryptocurrencies that are issued by individual people. You can redeem those currencies for those people, you know, those people's time or their product or their output. But in particular, if those people are artists, then presumably you would be exchanging the tokens for those artists' work. And, you know, this is where I get really excited and nerd out on like DeFi stuff and say like, well, what if we take the art coins of the top 10 artists who have tokenized their works, and what if we put them into a portfolio, something like there's something called Balancer, where you can put tokens in a portfolio at certain allocations, and the Balancer will sort of rebalance them at all times as their prices change. Well, that could be an index fund for, you know, investing in artists. Or you can imagine taking a collection like what we have at First Edition and locking it into a smart contract and then issuing, you know, your ERC20 tokens and then putting that into some kind of index fund. On the social token side, I've been watching that space. I do see that it's kind of an interesting space. It's growing. There's a few companies in it. Roll would be sort of the pioneer there. And then more recently, stakeonme.com has created an interesting like bonding curve experience for tokens. And generally, whenever I can, you know, I go and I try to play with these things. So I actually went on StakeOnMe and created a token called Jake. I'm not 100% sure like what I'm going to do with it. I think you might be able to redeem it for some of my artworks in the future. But yeah, that's something that I've played around with.
I love that. I just love the pace of innovation and the constant experimentation happening in this space, because experimentation leads to innovation and it grows the entire ecosystem massively. I love that. All right, let's dream a little bit. Tell me your grand vision for CoinFund, you know, 10, 20 years, whatever. Tell me your ultimate dream for what CoinFund can be.
Well, CoinFund is here to facilitate ideally the transition of our legacy world into a world of decentralized networks. And as we can see, you know, we've been doing, you know, blockchains existed for about a decade. This is a highly non-trivial process. It takes tons of people. It takes tons of founders. It takes tons of technology innovation, you know, anything from distributed consensus to like whole new areas of math around zero knowledge proofs. It takes conversations with regulators. It takes investors believing in the space and putting money into it. And it also takes sort of like open source, right? And supporting that side of things, because a lot of these decentralized products are built by, you know, individuals who are just kind of traveling the world and giving their expertise. This is a hugely rewarding space. It's a hugely diverse space in the sense of like what areas people come from and come together from in order to create blockchain technology. And so I think CoinFund has in many ways been there from the beginning. And, you know, our goal is to see some of these experiments, you know, actually succeed and create new opportunities for the world. So what we're, you know, what we do is we bridge the gap in many ways between highly decentralized crypto native technologies made by very idealistic people who might even have like crypto anarchistic tendencies to start with. And we combine that with a sense of sort of like responsibility and a language that we can explain to sort of more traditional folks from the investment community or the traditional investing world, right? And I think our team does that very well. Like we have in the partnership of CoinFund four people, all of whom have Wall Street experience. But on the other hand, we come from like totally different areas. Like I'm a technologist who used to work at Amazon, and you know, one of my partners is a lawyer, and one of my partners comes from finance. One of our partners comes from like quite literally Wall Street, like equity analysis, right, in public markets. And you know, we bring all of those sets of experience together to basically make the best investment decisions in a way that we think will positively impact the world.
You guys are kind of accelerating the transition from niche crypto to mainstream. So I think that's an incredibly important role that you guys are playing, and you guys are doing an amazing job. All right, let's jump into the closing questions. What is your single favorite NFT that you own?
That is a tough, tough question. You know, I do really like the fact that we own, the First Edition owns the Genesis building from Block Cities. And you can see that if you go to our website and you go to like the rares page, it's on there. And this is something that we acquired at auction, I think, when Block Cities was sort of creating some runway by selling the assets. They put this Genesis building up for auction on OpenSea. And we bid and we won. In many ways, it was to support the team there in that project. But in other ways, it perfectly fit sort of our first edition ethos to get like the rare one of one kind of Genesis building. So I'm going to go with that for this question.
Love that. All right. What is something that you'd like to see happen or something that you think needs to happen to the NFT ecosystem?
So I think that there is a huge opportunity in taking an issuance platform and using some of the learnings from the very crypto native side of things to do something like creating a token that gives everybody ownership in that platform, or maybe creating a DAO which makes decisions about, you know, which NFTs are kind of good, right? And maybe tokenizing that, right? And so, you know, the core problem of the space that I keep alluding to is that, you know, we have a very healthy supply side, but we don't have a huge demand side today. And that's really up to the space to create that demand. I think the way that they will do that is by opening up and using some of these core value propositions of blockchains to create liquidity for the buy side. And that means that creators can come in, they can create a lot of work, they can get paid. Some of them might be able to go full time in the same way that, you know, TikTok influencers sometimes can go full time and do that, right? And that work will eventually reach a critical mass that can no longer be ignored, and people will start buying excellent art in digital form. And I think that will spur the other side of the market. So I think any startup that's thinking about an issuance platform today should think about like, hey, can I do this a DAO? Can I do this with a token? Can I use some kind of crypto economic mechanism to make art more liquid for the creators? And I think that will play a huge role in getting this market going.
All right. What are the main barriers to adoption in the NFT space?
Well, I think there's always sort of platform barriers. So like I spend a non-trivial amount of time with artists who've like never used crypto or Ethereum before. And I can tell you the process of not so much getting them an address, but just explaining how things work is takes about an hour. It's like, oh, this is Ether. Oh, it moves in price. Oh, you have to send it to the smart contract in order to mint an artwork on the blockchain. Oh, you can see your NFT, not just in OpenSea, but in all of these platforms because it's a standard, right? Like getting the lay of the land is still quite a learning curve for new people. So there's always that cost that you're going to pay. Like you need the ether, you need the understanding. Once you have that, you know, I think there's just a lot of friction in terms of the usability of these platforms today. Not all of them work, not all of them work all the time, not all of them support the wallets. Not all of them work on mobile, and that's always a challenge. Like it's very frustrating if you're trying to sell some work and you have an interesting buyer, but oh, they can't pull it up on their phone, and so you lose a customer. It hurts the growth. And finally, you know, the lessons that kind of we talked about in the beginning that we learned from Additional is that mobile creates great engagement. And so I think a lot of the platforms today are missing things like mobile apps. Like I want to know when my favorite artist drops a work so I can go and buy it if I feel like it, right? But that kind of distribution is ultimately also what's going to make one platform more successful than another. Like as a creator, I very well know that there's only, you know, a handful of places where I can go and turn a digital artwork into Ether. And that, you know, has to do with their size. It has to do with how many buyers are on that platform and so on. So I think there's still a ton of friction, but again, as we get more artists, creators, buyers, and long-term holders, you know, I think that changes.
So if you were to dream up kind of the perfect solution in your mind, it would basically be a mobile app that allows you to buy Ethereum instantly with US dollars or fiat currency, and then also has interconnectivity to these non-fungible token platforms. Or how does that dream like app look in your mind?
I think that the app has to provide like a good interface for creators. So, you know, it has to have like a good set of tools and transparency and tracking and US dollar prices and the ability to like, you know, get more ether, certainly, but it also has to have good engagement for buyers, right? It needs to have notifications. It needs to present itself in a way that looks like an art product. Not all of the NFT venues look like art products, right? Like some of them look like, oh, this is an eBay for collectibles. And then others are more look more like products where artists spend their time. And so that kind of branding and user experience considerations also matters. But it's also like in many ways, I'm the wrong person to ask. It's like the teams that will, you know, do those experiments and see what works and see which user experiences kind of win users, you know, those are the teams that will be successful.
All right. Do you think that there is going to be a specific event that causes NFTs to go mainstream, something like another viral sensation like CryptoKitties? Or do you think it's going to be just a gradual grind of adoption?
That's a great question. We call that the inflection point, right? So like one thing that we think about is like Dapper's incoming launch of the Flow blockchain, right? Is that going to be an inflection point where suddenly millions of people are going to start buying NFTs? I don't know. There's a possibility that will happen. There's also a possibility that it will, you know, grind away and eventually reach a critical mass, and then it will inflect and go up exponentially. But ultimately, I think what is required is the connection of, you know, sort of like traditional legacy platforms with this space, right? So like one example is a lot of people talk about digital picture frames, and there's like four companies that have produced digital picture frames in the past. Even Samsung TVs, I hear, have an art marketplace where you could like buy a piece of art and like put it on your TV. But all those kinds of endeavors, they haven't really, you know, been super successful, and they haven't like generated huge markets. Well, precisely because there's not a huge market of digital online art that everyone can get behind. And the blockchain is exactly the technology that I think facilitates that market.
Love that. All right, last question. Where do you see the world of NFTs in 3 years?
Well, if I'm going to take the bullish stance, I'm going to go with we will like 20 to 50x our GMV in that world if we're successful. So that means like all the platforms are going to be, you know, doing that much volume. And even today, right, I see NFTs as some of the most kind of high GMV assets in all of blockchain, which are outside of the financial world, right? So if you don't count exchanges, if you don't count kind of like stablecoin transfers and things like that. Like, where are people actually using NFTs, you know, in consumer products? You land on this asset class. And if I'm being bullish, I think it'll grow hopefully over the next 3 years.
Wow, 20 to 50X in 3 years. I definitely can get behind that vision. That sounds very appealing to me.
Well, we'll see. I might be wrong, but you know, that kind of growth is what's required, I think, for traditional investors to really start paying attention and taking this space very seriously.
Absolutely. All right, Jake, this has been just awesome talking to you. I love your, you know, crypto specific knowledge and your NFT knowledge and kind of those two worlds melding together. It's been so cool hearing your insights and all this stuff. But if people want to reach out to you and, you know, I don't check out First Edition or check out CoinFund, where should they go? What should they do?
Yeah, totally. Check out First Edition. It's firstedition.xyz. And sign up for a newsletter on Substack. It's firsteditionxyz.substack.com. And then you'll get all the updates.
Awesome, Jake. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And you're going to have to come back on again in a few months' time and tell me everything that you've been up to.
All right, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, everyone. Stay tuned for more episodes of the Zima Red podcast and subscribe to the Zima Red newsletter for more info on all things NFTs. Thanks so much for listening.